Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, The Tom Woods Show.
Hey, everybody. Welcome back to The Tom Woods Show. This is episode 2434. And before I introduce our guest, I want to let you know I'm taking a week off at Christmas time. So you are looking at the final episode of The Tom Woods Show for 2023. So there's a lot of, let's say, expectation from David Stockman here in this episode. You recognize old David here. He, of course, is David is like living history because he was in the Reagan administration, but as such a young pup that he's still an energetic pup even now. And so he was the director of the Office of Management and Budget after having been a U.S. congressman. Then he had a distinguished private sector career. He's been writing books and doing commentary for quite some time. And we want to talk about his brand new book, Trump's War on Capitalism. So, David, welcome back.
Glad to be with you, Tom. And I like your term, living history. Some people consider me a relic. So I think living history is better.
Yeah, that's
but,
right.
You know, it's interesting because the issues don't change. I was elected to Congress, you know, almost a half century ago. The Reagan administration was 40 years ago. And yet we're still struggling with the same issues of too much spending, a national debt to just keep ballooning and mushrooming and rising, a pressure on the central bank to monetize more and more the debt and so forth. All of these things have only, you know, intensified, compounded since that time. And the reason I'm writing this book is that I think the hour is late. And unless we have a decisive shift in national policy back towards some version of fiscal rectitude, some idea that the Fed is not the all-powerful monetary central planning agency of not only the United States, but the planet, if we don't get back to some notion of federalism and smaller government in Washington, some notion of a peaceful foreign policy that's not based on global hegemony and intervention everywhere, I think the jig will be up. It will not be able to preserve constitutional democracy or free market prosperity in America. Now, so that's on the line. And the question is, how can we stop the drift? How can we get the big shift in direction? And the answer is, until we have a genuine conservative party in this country on fundamental economics, these issues that I've just talked about, and on the question of our role in the world and, you know, the welfare state, the warfare state that goes with it, until we have a basic shift to a strong conservative party, I don't see a lot of hope for turning around the ship of state. Now, the problem is, to get to the book, the heart of it, Donald Trump isn't a conservative in any way, shape, or form economically.
All right. Let me direct the way we're going to unpack this here.
Yeah,
because
okay.
Let me begin. I'm going to begin by playing devil's advocate here and saying,
sure,
if Trump says something like, look, we're going to make Social Security even stronger and we're not even going to consider looking at ways to make it sustainable, or if that's even doable, or Medicare, this holds no interest for him, and he is against any changes to it. And we may say, well, this is really frustrating because those are the two major, major items that at some point have to be looked at because they clearly are not sustainable. But it seems like if I were to pick Trump out and say, well, look at Trump, he's no good on these issues, the whole Republican Party is bad on those issues. And even if you bring out a Paul Ryan, the difference between Paul Ryan and Trump is Paul Ryan wants to hire a commission to look into it, and then they'll ignore what the commission says, you know? I mean, I don't think Trump is alone in this, is my point.
No, I agree with you. And unfortunately, the Republican Party in the last, say, half decade has drifted further and further away from the fundamentals of fiscal rectitude, but partly because it's been Trumpified. You know, Trump insisted stoutly while he was in office for 4 years that they were going to touch Social Security or Medicare or any entitlements. He said he was going to repeal Obamacare, and it was a half-hearted effort, and it didn't pan out, and no political capital was really spent. But since then, he's become even more militant in insisting those huge entitlements, the whole transfer payment budget is sacrosanct. And so if he is renominated and the Republican Party is led by Trump again in the next 4 years, I think it's all over except the shouting. Any voices in the party that might want to face the fiscal facts of life have been totally smothered. You remember what happened when they passed that huge CARES Act sight unseen in March 2020 after the lockdowns were proposed and so forth. It was $2.2 trillion. No one had even read the 180 pages, whatever it was. The one guy who opposed it, you know, the congressman from Kentucky, Thomas Massie, he got denounced and shouted down by Trump. And Trump even demanded that he be purged from the Republican Party. So that's what we're up against. I agree with you. Without Trump, we still have a real battle in front of us, but at least there's some hope the Republican Party can come back to its senses.
All right, well, let's dig into some statistics here. Now, by the way, actually, before we even do that, the problem is it looks like Republicans, like the Republican base, doesn't really seem to have much interest in issues like this. They say they do, but I don't think they do. The general public, I don't think they do. For example, the Tea Party was a brief flash in the pan, but even they, were they willing to make the kinds of cuts that would be necessary? I highly doubt it. So unfortunately, you're making your stand on maybe the most unpopular thing of all. I mean, it's easy to go after woke leftists or Antifa criminals or whatever, because everybody understands how crazy that is.
Yes.
But people like getting checks in the mail with their names on them. And that is a very, very hard addiction to break.
I agree with you. And the worst episode of that was with the so-called stimmies in response to the lockdown, in which everyone got a check except maybe the top 10% of the households in terms of economic levels. In other words, households up to $150,000 of income were getting those stimmy checks of $1,200, $1,400, $500 for the kids, as I lay out in the book. After that first act during the summer, fall of 2020, if you were a family of four with two wage earners and got laid off, you got all the stimmy checks, the child care credits. You were also eligible for the unemployment topper on top of, which was $1,000 a week, on top of the state benefits. It could add up to $30,000, $40,000, even $50,000 a year of handouts from the government. That happened on Trump's watch. He signed it. It was the worst excess of that thing that we've encountered yet. And it's another reason why I think he's already proved he's not even remotely the right person for the job.
So what you're doing in this book, in part, is going through the Trump record and arguing that it's not all it was cracked up to be in terms of economic performance. But you're also talking about what Trump's own personal opinions are on various economic topics. And those
right.
are both very important things. So let's start, even though a president doesn't really have that much control over monetary policy, the president, though, can nominate someone for Fed chairman. And I would like whoever the president is to be sensible enough to choose a decent enough Fed chairman. I mean, I'd be very, very happy if Jim Grant were chosen to be Fed chairman, because maybe something might happen. But since Paul Volcker, I don't know that there's been anybody either as a Fed chair or as a U.S. president who's actually been serious about really trying to make the dollar worth something again and keep an eye on rising prices and really, really crack down. I don't know of anybody. So again, are we being unfair to Trump is my question.
Well, I don't think we are, because the subsequent presidents, Reagan actually, and of course, you know, I was there. Reagan was a pretty stout defender of what the Fed needed to do and what Volcker was doing to bring down that double-digit inflation that we inherited. And the other Republican politicians around him in the White House and on Capitol Hill were constantly pushing, you've got to tell Volcker to take his foot off the neck on the economy. Howard Baker said that, and others were putting on the pressure. But he really didn't yield. The big mistake he made was after the fight was won, after Volcher won, he should have been reappointed in 1987. I convinced him that Volcher wasn't reliable and Alan Greenspan would make a wonderful replacement. Well, we know how that would pop. Now, my point here, Tom, is that the president since then, the Bushes, have basically been kind of lukewarm, tepid on the monetary issue. They didn't demand the Fed open up the spigots and print money, you know, like there was no tomorrow. But they didn't demand sound money policy either. The problem is when Trump got in, he leaned way the other way. He was constantly on the case, going after the Fed, about interest rates, which were at zero effectively when he got there, and the belated efforts of the Fed to try to get interest rates moving back into some semblance of rationality, he constantly thwarted and opposed. Now, this is important because his term began in 2017 after we were well into the business cycle recovery after the Great Recession. And, you know, even sort of conservative slash Keynesian Friedmanites that had dominated the Republican Party always believed that when you got into the middle and back end of the business cycle, it was time to sober up. You needed to get back to market rates of interest. You needed to get the budget balanced or even in surplus. Trump went the other way. When they tried, as you remember, belatedly to begin raising interest rates, and then they went into QT in 2018 and 2019, Trump was all over the case of the Fed and blaming them for even, you know, trying to get interest rates within the range of something that was meaningful in real terms after inflation. So that's why I think the indictment is so strong. It came at the wrong time, and it was really the wrong message, utterly wrong. As I say in the book, I think that he was more irresponsible, reckless on monetary policy than, you know, William Jennings Bryan or Wright Patton or any other monetary quacks who've made their way across the scene in American economic history recently. So again, we can't have someone back in the Oval Office who's going to be on the Fed's case to ease money, to lower interest rates, to buy in the federal debt, which is exactly what I think predictably he would do if he gets a second term.
I think the thing that bothers me the most is you have a passage in the book quoting Trump on his opinions on monetary policy. Now, there are some things I am later on, David, so mentally prepare yourself. I am later on going to ask you to name me a couple of good things about Trump, okay? So get those wheels turning, okay?
Yeah.
But on things like this, you just, I mean, any sensible person at all just has to shake his head because he would say things, he speaks as if there is no downside to lowering interest rates. That, of course, we all like low interest rates. And so the only obstacle is a lack of political will or dummies on the Federal Reserve Board or whatever. Like there are no economic consequences. There's no meaning to interest rates. They can just be arbitrarily set wherever we like. Like you wouldn't even pause to wonder. I wonder, I mean, it seems like there is absolutely no reason not to do this, but there must be some. I wonder what it is.
Well, it's obvious that a market set interest rates are what allocates capital, what allocates economic activity. If we've known for decades and decades and decades, the price system is fundamental to capitalist prosperity. And if we don't have at least reasonably honest quasi-market prices in the financial system, we're going to end up with the mess we have today, huge financial bubbles. We're going to be sending the wrong message to Capitol Hill. In other words, the federal debt doesn't matter, because the carry cost, actually, of the debt, when the Fed finally had the interest rates down to rock bottom, averaged 1.6%. Well, you know, the politicians aren't going to worry about the cost of financing the debt and the carry cost of the debt if you drive the weighted average cost of the $34 trillion federal debt to almost a rounding error. So the problem is, if you want to turn Wall Street into a speculative casino, and if you want to turn Washington into a runaway spending machine, then artificially depress interest rates to non-economic levels. And I have a chart in the book, which I think is worth bringing up here. And that is, if you take the period between the spring of 2008, right before the Great Recession actually hit, and a year ago, March 2022, when the Fed finally reversed direction, the real interest rate, if you subtract the funds rate, if you subtract the year-over-year inflation from the federal funds rate, was negative 95% of the time in terms of months elapsed. Of the 183 months, it was negative for 170 months. Now, that's crazy, because for that long period of time, you were sending a signal to both Wall Street to speculate in the carry trades to your heart's content. You were sending a message to the other end of the sell order to Capitol Hill. You know, you can talk about the fiscal problem down the road, but don't worry about it today or tomorrow or next year even, because the carry cost is a rounding error. Now, it's already been reversing, okay? Even with the mild anti-inflation efforts that is taken, the weighted average cost of the federal debt is rising rapidly. If you look at the market right now, almost everything is above 4%. In terms of three-year bills, all without 30-year bonds. And that's about three times on average what the carry cost was 2 years ago. So as these rates filter in, as the portfolio rolls over, the cost of servicing the federal debt's going to soar. That's just math. That's arithmetic. It's already up to $1 trillion on an annualized run rate now, and it's going to get a lot worse. So you ask, what is the downside of pushing interest rates to rock bottom? The answer is the greatest bubble in history on Wall Street. And I call it a doomsday fiscal machine in Washington, that there is no indication that anybody's going to do anything about it.
Let's take a minute to thank our sponsor, Blinkist. Christmas is coming, and that means your friends and family are once again going to feed your book addiction. You and I have far more books than we can possibly read. And as I've said, by the time we finish one, we've already bought two or three more. And don't pretend that isn't you, dear listener, because I know my listeners like I know myself. The Blinkist app can help. With Blinkist, you can absorb huge amounts of information, the kind that satisfies your natural curiosity, as well as the kind that will help you be more successful in business and in life. We're talking 27 nonfiction categories. Blinkist condenses each book into 15-minute summaries you can read or listen to, so you get all the meat from the book and none of the fluff. So some books you'll say, wow, I definitely want to go and read the whole thing now. For others, you might say, well, I think that's just about all I need. So if you have half an hour in terms of your commute each way, you can be absorbing every day the equivalent of four books. You think that might make you a more impressive person? And by the way, you will also find libertarian classics in there, like Rothbard and Friedman, and even a book by Ole Woods here. Well, right now, Blinkist has a special offer just for our audience. Go to Blinkist.com/Woods to start your 7-day free trial and get 25% off a Blinkist premium membership. That's Blinkist, spelled B-L-I-N-K-I-S-T, Blinkist.com/Woods, to get 25% off and a 7-day free trial. Blinkist.com/Woods. And now, for a limited time, you can even use Blinkist Connect to share your premium account. You get two premium subscriptions, the price of one. Let me talk about the performance of the Trump economy, if I may, because
Sure. This
is the major Trump talking point, isn't it? That I gave the country the best economy. And in fact, I mean, sometimes we've come to expect the kind of over-the-top language that Trump will use. I gave our country the best economy any country has ever had, that kind of thing. And I think if you were to ask people today, were you in better shape under Trump than you are now? Well, I'm quite sure people would say that they were. But that's a pretty low bar, I would say. So what are some of the areas that we would want to look at in order to make the determination this was a good time or a bad time economically for America?
Well, first of all, I like your point on a very low bar. The one thing these politicians never remind people of is that we do have, even with all the government roadblocks that now exist, a pretty healthy capitalist system that generates growth on average year in and year out. And so every 4 years, people are going to be slightly better off on average than they were 4 years ago. The question is, when you look at Trump, how would you judge those 4 years with all of the other presidential terms going back to Truman? That's what I did in the book. And I do make the caveat that there's some limits to doing this because the economy doesn't work on the arbitrary 48-month cycle of the federal election process. So you have to be a little careful because their economic cycles, economic trends start and end at points that are far different than presidential terms and for reasons that are not entirely or even mainly controllable in the Oval Office. Nevertheless, when you put all that, you know, on the table, the point is that the average real economic growth rate during the 4 years of Trump's tenure was 1.5%. The average for all presidents since Truman was 3.0%. So his rate was half of the average for good presidents, bad presidents, presidents in between, periods of war, periods of peace, periods of crisis, periods of relative stability. It's the worst record of any presidential term going back to Harry Truman. Now, that's on the fundamental metric of real growth. You can look at jobs. Trump, obviously, and the worst jobs record of any president since Truman, or even Herbert Hoover, for that matter, when he took office, there were 145.3 million non-farm payroll jobs. When he left, there were 142.3 million. So we lost 3 million jobs during his tenure. That's never happened before. And of course, people will say, well, that was because of the COVID. And if you set that aside, it was better. Well, the point is the COVID didn't cause the economy to go into depression or recession in the spring of 2020. It didn't cause 20 million people to be suddenly thrown out of work. What caused that was the lockdowns. And the lockdowns were hatched in the White House. They were announced from the White House. They were endorsed by Trump over and over. He enabled Fauci. He enabled Deborah Birx and the whole rest of the malpracticing crew of doctors that took the country down the tubes. And so I go with the basic Harry Truman slogan, which was the buck stops here. He authorized all this. It happened on his watch. The lockdowns were basically instigated and implemented from the White House fully open. So you can't say, well, other than the last 10 months, everything was fine. Well, no, in the last 10 months, the American economy lost 10 million jobs. That's why things weren't fine. Now, we can look at other measures too. I lay it all out. Productivity growth, that was the worst on his watch of any president since the 50s. And as Republicans, conservatives, we've always believed that productivity growth is the heart of how we get real wealth and real improvement living standards. We can look at investment. We can look at savings. We can look at ultimately real per capita income. On average, real per capita income, which is a pretty good metric for living standards for Main Street America. On the average, it was about 2% growth over the entire 70, 80 years of post-war America. Under Trump, it was barely 1% or half of the norm. So the point that we should re-elect Trump because we had a strong MAGA economy is a myth. It's wrong. It doesn't stand up to history. So why would you want to have bad policies, clearly, when all of the key measures, spending, money printing, debt, intervention, and so forth, he's way off base. Why would you want to reelect him? Because he claims to produce the wonderful MAGA economy, when that didn't happen either. Now, you said before, Tom, you're going to ask me, what are the good things about Trump? Okay. Well, I have one really good thing. His redeeming virtue is that he has all the right enemies. Okay. You know, he is roundly opposed by the New York Times, the Washington Post, CNN, the Washington Permanent Establishment, the so-called deep state national security apparatus. So those are all good things. But the problem is, if your policies are all wrong, or if they're half-heartedly or not even implemented at all, then the virtue of having the right enemies doesn't get you very far. Even on the case like the national security policy, he did say some kind of right things about why do we still have NATO when the Soviet Union disappeared 30 years ago? Why do we have the forever wars? America first, he talked about. But then what did he do? He took the defense budget from $600 billion, that was way too big, that he inherited from Obama, and raised it to $850 billion, which is totally out of control, but it's providing so much gravy to the military-industrial complex that it's become a self-fueling, self-fulfilling operation. There's so much money spilling over the sides that goes into lobbying, that goes into all these think tanks and all these NGOs that are behind our interventionist foreign policy, that it basically perpetuates them. What I'm saying is, if you really believed in America first, you would have gone for a fortress American defense policy that would have caused a huge cut in the $600 billion, not a 50% increase. And making these cuts, you would have snuffed out the flow of all that money that keeps the Washington war machine in power. But he didn't do that. He fueled the war machine. And then when he tried to make some steps in the right direction, like getting us out of Syria, what the hell were we doing in Syria? They basically ignored his own policies, and it never happened. And we're still there. And now we're in the middle of it at this very moment in time. So what I'm saying is, the right enemies do not produce the right candidate. And in this case, he's clearly the wrong candidate at this late hour.
Well, let me, as long as you drifted into the question I was going to ask you, let me just say a brief word, even though it's not a major feature of your book, but a brief word about Ukraine here, because I do think he's legitimately better on that than a lot of Republicans. I am not entirely sure where Ron DeSantis comes down on it. And I think that's a bad sign. But the thing is, you know, as you say, David, he might have some good instincts on foreign policy from time to time. But you'd think that would be a golden opportunity to then cut back on the spending related to it.
Right.
If we don't need to be in all these ridiculous wars, then surely we also don't need a military buildup like this that only benefits certain companies and doesn't benefit Americans. I mean, you could easily, I mean, there, that's all you have to say. To put it in a America first idiom. I just made it up now.
Yeah.
And we ended up getting the opposite.
Well, here's the thing, though. I agree with that. And rhetorically, every now and then he says the right thing. And on the Ukraine, which is a total disaster, we shouldn't be involved. We don't have to go through that whole issue. He's kind of chirped some words in the right direction. But who does he appoint for all of the major jobs in his administration? If you put John Bolton in as national security advisor, if you put Pompeo in as secretary of state, and before that, head of the CIA, what are you doing? These are the very worst, most extreme, most over-the-top neocon interventionists that hang around the Republican Party. At least half of the people on Capitol Hill, Republicans, I mean, are not quite as bad as Pompeo and Bolton. So, you know, the point is, Trump is lazy. He's mentally inert. As far as I'm concerned, he doesn't think anything through. And how, with the thoughts that he articulated about America first, he could have appointed these people and many others at lower levels. I mean, the whole deep state was appointed into the Defense Department, into the security apparatus, into the National Endowment for Democracy, into AID, all the rest of it, there were no America Firsters in there. They were all warfare state firsters. So I don't have a lot of sympathy for him saying the right things on that topic. But also, what did he do during the 4 years? He should have been paving the way for us to get out of the mess we created there after the coup in 2014. But he didn't. The same people stayed in, and eventually you got the current leadership in Ukraine that have led to this disaster that we have there at the moment. Now, I would also say the other problem is that if Trump got us slightly out of the fire in Eastern Europe, the Ukraine, he'd probably get us deeper into the swamp in the Far East because he's got this crazy China fixation that he's likely to just exacerbate the tensions there when, you know, we should be trying to settle the Taiwan thing and get out of the way in the Far East as well. So it's not very promising, no matter how you look at it.
Can we jump in for a minute to the trade issue? Because, of course, that was one of his signature issues, was that the U.S. was in very unfavorable trade deals and we were going to make a difference there. Can we talk about maybe, I almost hate to talk about unintended consequences of government policy, because I feel like half the time they are intended, or it would only have taken them 5 minutes of thinking to realize this would be a consequence. But did these tariffs have any unfavorable impacts on American agriculture?
I'm pretty sure they did, because there was retaliation by the Chinese. So the problem, I think, is a bigger picture question, and that is, ironically, Trump campaigned against the swamp, fine, but he also has a view on the world that says all of the ills that confront America, that confound our progress, are due to foreigners, okay? Foreigners coming across the border with Mexico, foreigners who engage in deceptive and nefarious trade schemes and protectionism and so forth. And so we'll solve the problem by putting a wall up at the border against immigrants and a wall up in the ports, a tariff wall against imports, and thereby saying the problem arises from foreigners when actually the problem arises from policy coming out of the swamp in Washington. So again, we've gone in the wrong direction. We need a large-scale guest worker program. We desperately need more labor, particularly lower-skill or middle-skill labor. It's there waiting at the border, and yet we have this crazy campaign against immigrants and in favor of really harsh policies at the border. We have a trick. Now, when it comes to trade, obviously, American economic position in the world has been totally undermined by the Fed as a result of all the inflation that has created over the last 3 or 4 decades. So again, if you want to address the problem of the offshoring of millions of American jobs, of too many imports, and we do have, you know, an unsustainable import-export imbalance, then you have to go to the cause. You have to go to the source, which is the exporting of fiat dollars to the entire world, which has caused everybody else money and to engage in mercantilist trade policies. So again, completely wrong solutions from the point of view of any notion of free market capitalism.
Brief but important message from Ol Woods here. Hundreds, if not thousands, of my readers are joining me in something pretty darn exciting next month, and I'd like you to be one of them. We are going to make 2024 the best year any of us have ever had. We're not going to do that by thinking positive or wishing or hoping or, heaven help us, with feckless New Year's resolutions. We're going to be following my system, which involves none of those useless things. This system has taken me from my very lowest point to having exactly the life I want in terms of finances, relationships, health, hobbies, work-life balance, the whole package. I didn't get there at random or by drifting along. If you drift along, you can expect drift-along results. I got there instead by following the specific, no-fluff, step-by-step program that has given me a better life than I could ever have expected. I want you to have results like that, and you can. Do this alongside me. If you sit down and complete the exercises by the end of January 2024, you can ask me for your money back, and I'll gladly give it to you. If I told you I was giving you a free goal-setting program, nobody would do it, trust me. But since this is the first time I'm ever offering this, you have no testimonials to go on. You just have to trust me. So to lower your risk to virtually zero, I've added that feature. Just complete it, and you can have your money back if you choose. How's that for an offer? Get ready to write me a note in 2024 expressing astonishment at how much your life has changed for the better. You can go through the program at your leisure. There'll be only one live session, an optional orientation with me on January 2nd. Now, you may be skeptical. I completely understand. If I hadn't done this myself, I would be the same way. But just wait and see. You will be sending me that note. Next December, my homepage for this site will consist almost entirely of testimonials. Now, naturally, if your life is already fulfilling and satisfying in every area, this isn't for you. But if you're a human like the rest of us, it is. As we head into 2024, let's do something thrilling together. The website, 2024crusher.com. I want to ask you something that is very, very tangentially related to the book. What is your impression of Vivek Ramaswamy?
I think he's pretty interesting, actually. For a guy who's not much time put in, as far as I can tell, in his career, because he's young, he's high 30s, he has absorbed a fairly large amount of information and has a decent understanding of a lot of issues, particularly when it comes to foreign policy and, the U.S. hegemony and the world and the policemen of the world and all of that. He's got a lot of good insights on wokedom and that. So I usually give him some good marks. I don't think he has any snowball's chance in the hot place of getting near anything that looks like political power or a nomination. But I'm glad that he's on the stage in these debates because he's bringing up stuff that the conventional Republicans there at the loudmouths don't articulate. You know, the only real answer to this whole thing is coming from the other direction. I think there is a decent chance that Robert Kennedy Jr. will pick up enough support among young voters, independent voters, people fed up with the uniparty status quo, that he might decisively impact the election by winning. He only has to win one or two states because the red state, blue state divide is so uneven that you don't get 270 votes in the Electoral College. I mean, in theory, when New Hampshire has four electoral votes, nobody gets 270 and goes to the House of Representatives. They vote by delegation, not by numbers, and you're in a whole ball game where some major deals could be made to change the direction of policy, starting with the warfare state, starting with Ukraine, starting with this $900 billion defense budget, which is really $1.3 trillion, if you count all the other stuff, including veterans related to defense. The reason that I support him as an alternative in this upcoming election is the uniparty needs to be broken up. And that means if the Republican Party ends up falling apart and we get this electoral stalemate and crisis in 2024, so much the better. It's a very risky thing, obviously, but I think it's the only way that we can break the hold of the uniparty. If you don't have Donald Trump, one of these others, although the governor of Florida, DeSantis, I give some good credit to in terms of he saw the light on COVID and the lockdowns and medical freedom. He's been pretty decent on fiscal and other issues. But, the odds are unless the Republican establishment is completely discredited, he'll still be no more successful in changing the course if he were nominated and even elected than anybody else it's been to date.
What do you think the Republican primary would have looked like if Trump had not been around or had chosen not to run?
Well, it's kind of a hard what-if question. You know, I think DeSantis had a pretty good head of steam, and it was only because the Democrats were stupid enough to weaponize the Justice Department and go after him in this insane way that they're doing now that they create sympathy backlash among the Republican base and the MAGA constituencies and put him back in the saddle and way ahead. If that hadn't happened, as you say, with your question, I think DeSantis would have had it because he did so well in the last election and he's turned a purple state down here in Florida where I think we both are almost red. So I think he could have done pretty well. But now that Trump is all over the primary and has it dominated, that's the first sentence of my book, the establishment,
I can't believe this,
the establishment is rallying behind Nikki Haley. Okay. I mean, how much can you go in the wrong direction than rally around and try to stop Trump with a neocon interventionist that's probably the worst yet? I mean, in terms of even the Bushes weren't as bad as Nikki Haley sounds in her foreign policy positions. It's just another reason why I think the Uniparty has to be broken up and the Republican Party sent to the showers for a total redo.
Are you surprised, though, that somebody with the views of a Nikki Haley, I mean, yes, I know she's, quote, surging. I think this is an entirely manufactured surge.
Yeah.
But nevertheless, I mean, she's clearly, she's not in the lead by any means. She's not the front runner, as somebody like her clearly would have been 10, 12 years ago. Are you surprised by how quickly somebody with her views is, frankly, kind of down in the basement?
I'm surprised, but I'm not, because essentially, at some point a few months ago, the establishment decided there was no stopping Trump, that DeSantis wasn't going to cut the mustard for one reason or another. And so all of a sudden, CNN and the New York Times and all the rest of them have rallied behind her cause. They've created a momentary sensation. I think it's very worrisome that she could do better than expected in Iowa and come in a strong second in New Hampshire. And, you know, why are we wasting our time on Nikki Haley? Okay. We really need to have a Taft Republican. And of course, the Taft Republicans, by that I mean Robert Taft, the Fortress America view of the world, the non-interventionist view, they're represented maybe, by Rand Paul and anyone like Rand Paul or Thomas Massie don't have any traction at all in terms of the Republican nomination because it's been so dominated by the neocons, and the Republican Party is so much of a incumbents club that it's a club of careerists, like, you know, the leader of the Senate, Mitch McConnell, who spent their whole life in the system and their old lock, stock, and barrel by the swoop. And until that changes, and that's sort of a whole area not in my book, but something I'm beating the tom-toms on, we have to have constitutional amendments to basically shift the base of power from careerist incumbents to citizen legislators. And the only way you're going to get there is with term limits and a huge ban on interest group financing. Now, I know some of the conservatives can get all worried about that, but in the scheme of things, I have this idea that I worked on in 1970 when I first went to Capitol Hill. It was a good idea then, and we should pursue it now, which is to have federal matching payments for small contributions up to $250 from citizens in America, tens of millions of them, and prohibit any other campaign financing outside of those small contributions and matching payments. Do that and put term limits 6 years on the House, Senate, and president. Nobody can run for re-election. 6-year terms for all. Maybe you could rescue American democracy from the grip of incumbency
and the swamp, for a better, one of the better term.
Well, the book is Trump's War on Capitalism. And I'll say David Stockman is not going to become the world's most popular guy by writing a book like this, because there is a very substantial Trump following that just won't hear any criticism. And I've just never been that way with politicians. You know, I mean, from time to time, I'll find somebody I think is pretty good, but is not so good on some things. And if you point out to me that the person's not so good on some things, I don't take that personally. I don't respond hysterically. I don't say, oh, yeah, well, your guy is also bad. I say, yeah, you're right. You know, these really are weaknesses and we need to be aware of them. Unfortunately, that's just not the way people act. And so, you know, David, who may indeed under normal conditions have many followers and supporters who happen now to be in the Trump camp, will now be viewed as the devil incarnate. And he's not going to be cheered by the left just because he's criticizing Trump, because he's criticizing him the wrong way. So the fact that you did this, you know, to me says that you want to tell the truth the way you see it, and you just let the chips fall where they may.
That's what I think I've done in the book. And it's not just because I want to be an iconoclast or I want to oppose something popular like Trump. It's because we have to get back to the right policies. The hour is late. And I would rather have another 4 years of stalemate in Washington with the Democrats monkeyed around the way they are under Biden than allow the Republican Party to be totally Trumpified by unprincipled, egomaniac that would just waste the 4 years and tarnish the brand. That's the thing that I think is really the bottom line here. Trump has tarnished the brand so badly, not on the issues the establishment talks about, you know, that he wants to be a dictator and all that. That's a lot of baloney and, all the Russiagate and all the rest of it. He's tarnished the brand because the people don't know anymore that we're going bankrupt as a country. He's tarnished the brand because the Republican Party doesn't even stand up for a minute to the Fed, which is utterly out of control and ruining the whole fundamental basis of capitalism in America. He tarnished the brand when he put the lockdowns on and destroyed really millions of small businesses and livelihoods and jobs of people who were in the wrong sectors of the economy by the light of Dr. Fauci and the rest of these authoritarians. So I think those are the reasons why, I had to write what I did.
Well, again, the book is Trump's War on Capitalism. I'll have it linked in the description of the video, also at tomwoods.com/2434. David, thank you very much. I appreciate your time. And I want to, again, remind people, this is the last episode of 2023, and I will be producing more of them starting at the very beginning of the new year. So Merry Christmas to all you good folks, and happy 2024, and I'll see you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit tomwoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.